what's the spiritual room? For me, it does tend to be a connection to something greater than just me. It is a contemplative space. It is getting to the core of who I am, allowing in some ways for the best of me to come to the fore, to have space for grace or allow for grace. I am humbled by what people bring to tell me. I take what I'm doing in the office very seriously because it's really like sacred work in terms of people being able to work, love, and play. I mean, that is for them to find their real callings, you could say, rather than the false selves that they may experience. It's a similar call for finding one's true self, and that is really important work.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. We've been talking to elders in our field, people who've been practicing for 50 plus years, and they share with us how they view this field evolving and where they see it going. We also talk to clinicians who had professions prior to becoming psychoanalysts, and they share with us their journeys to doing what they now love. These are just samplings of the psychoanalysts we've been talking with, again, from all corners of the globe. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Ginta Remakis. Dr. Remakis is a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst and practices in Rockville, Maryland. And our conversation today focuses on Dr. Remakis' Catholicism, specifically her Lithuanian Catholicism. She shares with us how it lived in her growing up experience and its evolutions and permutations in her adult life, how it did and didn't play a role in her choice of medicine, psychiatry, and psychoanalysis. We consider what prayer means to her, about her sense of spirituality, how that is similar to and different from her sense of God. We also spoke about both the similarities and differences in speaking freely, free associating, if you will, speaking freely with God and speaking freely with one's analyst. She shares with us her observations on the narthex, N-A-R-T-H-E-X. The narthex is the antechamber to a church, and how she finds it a meaningful similarity with the waiting room of an analytic office. She also speaks about how the structure of a mass has much in common with the structure of an analytic session. We take up the topic of abortion, about which she has written in the past, And we also talk about whether she has felt in any way as an outsider in our field, given how present religion is in her life. Dr. Romakis had served on the medical staff of Chestnut Lodge. She has presented widely on intergenerational transmission of trauma, diaspora experiences, the psychic role of language, especially bilingualism, the use of literature for processing trauma, and psychodynamics around disability. In 2003, she organized the New Directions Weekend Conference entitled The Future of Religion in the Psychoanalytic World, Revisiting the Mind-Soul Dilemma. And for several years, she presented on issues of psychiatry and religion to Georgetown's psychiatry residency. She is also a published poet in Lithuanian in several collections and journals. I learned a great deal from my conversation with Dr. Romakis. It's the interface between these two worlds sort of coalesces in her description of her feeling that she feels her clinical work is sacred, and that sense of sacred borrows from much in her life, including her religious background. I hope you find this as intriguing as I did. Ginta, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad you're able to be here. Ginta, we've been having conversations with analysts about the presence of religion in the analyst, in the analysand, and in some way in the analytic space. But it lives in sort of a funny dimension. It's sort of somewhere between private and secret. And as a result, I'm particularly appreciative for your joining us to share with us your experience of your Catholicism and how it lives in your life and what presence it has in your clinical work. We live in a time where many in our field are becoming interested in how cultural forces impact intrapsychic life and hence analytic life. And certainly we should be considering religious affiliations and beliefs as part of those cultural forces. Though, to my reading of the literature, that seems to be less appreciated. And by that I mean not just the religious story that a person brings to us, but also the meaning to the two parties about whether the two parties belong manifestly to the same religion or manifestly to a different religion, how that lives in the setting. But whether an adult comes manifestly a-religious or manifestly deeply religious, there's a story to be told and unpacked. And the story usually, as many stories, goes back to childhood and family life. Now, you've been very involved in your religious life, and you're going to share that with us. And some of the things that we've spoken of that you'll share with our listeners that are important to you is the role of prayer, is your relationship to God, and the subject of abortion, which is something you've published on in the past and is an important topic, and we will get to it in a bit. But how about if you start us off by telling us your origin story, your family story of your Catholicism, the particular variant that you belong to, and how you grew in it, how you're also, as you described, taking a sabbatical from it, and help us understand all that. So the floor is yours.
So, yeah, right now I would describe myself as a Lithuanian Catholic on lengthy sabbatical. So I do emphasize that I'm Lithuanian because it brings certain flavors to my Catholicism. Lithuania usually quite proudly says that it remembers that they are the last country in Europe to get Christianized. And one of the effects of that is that the indigenous religion is very present even in today's expressions of Catholicism. So it was Lithuania got Christianized in about the 14th century, which is pretty late. And in terms of people's beliefs, that even that didn't mean that people accepted it even then. And how it's present now is, for example, if you see a Lithuanian cross, you're going to see the horizontal and the vertical bars, but really around the crossing, you have rays of the sun. And so really, you're still seeing the sun, which represents one of the most important focal aspects of the more indigenous religion, which is more nature-based, as it is in many parts of the world. So it's very alive, even in the practice of Catholicism. So, and Catholic, Catholic means actually universal. So it's interesting, coming from the word holos, I think is the etymology of the word Catholic. Now, I do have and have throughout my life had certain issues with the Catholicism, while on the other hand, accepting being impacted by other aspects. And at this point, I've ended up on what I call a lengthy sabbatical. It may be certain questions, disappointments that have got me there, but on sabbatical also means I'm not throwing it away. Mm-hmm, and sure. I come back to campus occasionally to weddings, to funerals. Maybe just sometimes I might want to go to mass.
Can you tell us about your growing up experience and the place of Catholicism in that growing up?
Yeah, so my parents and grandparents were displaced persons from Europe, so they were refugees, so they brought the Catholicism with them. My grandmother was a simple woman who had like a third grade education, but she's someone I would see praying her rosary, and she would sometimes say things to us like "negreshik dievoi," which is translated maybe like don't tempt fate, but like don't screw around with God or with whatever it is.
Every religion seems to have that.
Right. And it's, yeah. So, and she wouldn't necessarily, she would always go to church, but she wouldn't necessarily be following what's going on in church. She prayed her rosary.
And she lived with you, your grandmother?
Yeah. So we had like a multi-generational household. My grandmother took care of us because my mom was working. My grandmother and grandfather lived upstairs. Mm-hmm. My mom was also very religious, especially when I was young. There's also the whole, as part of the refugee experience, there was a rush to make sure that the young people would receive communion and even be confirmed before they had to flee. There was a feeling of like things are going to happen, so we better get some of these sacraments taken care of. And I would see my mother praying, actually even kneeling down by the bedside every evening. Now, my father, and this is also consistent with kind of Lithuanian experience, he very much questioned religion. The only time he ever received communion, I guess, as an adult was at my parents' wedding. My mother asked him to, and he did. But he didn't accept the meaning of communion. But he would often there were certainly times he would go to church with the whole family, and he also had some feeling that it was important to that was part of the whole community experience. So, mm-hmm, yes. As part of being Lithuanian, that's one of the places where that was experienced. Certainly the holidays, something like the Christmas Eve dinner, it was important to him. And when he would say something along the lines of a blessing or a toast, he would talk about the importance of the ritual meal and the connections to.
So he was sort of culturally religious, as one might say nowadays.
Yes and no. He also very much was interested in questions of religion. And for example, it was not unusual that he would discuss things with Lithuanian Jesuits were very present in our community. So the priest, the Jesuit who married my parents and baptized all of us, was also someone that my father liked to talk with. And in fact, one organization would have like these retreats around Easter. One year, this priest couldn't do it. My father actually led the discussion, and he's the one who's. But that organization allowed for, you know, like someone like him to explore in that vein.
And you went to Catholic school straight through?
Right. Well, from kindergarten through high school. I very definitely had decided I was not going to go to a Catholic college or university, but
because you were disenchanted or you wanted something different?
Both. But also I do appreciate a lot of what I did get out of a Catholic education. It's a mixed bag. On the one hand, there were certain kind of weirdnesses, I would even say, at Catholic school, like you show up and then you have to go to church and the girls have to wear beanies. And it was like, you know, because you had to cover your head. While on the other hand, during Sunday Mass, you saw women wearing very nice, like these almost like veils, lace coverings. They were beautiful. So I don't know why they made you do something that was like, you didn't want to do. But there were also daily kind of, you know, I don't know, hierarchies. Like if someone is a priest or a nun, just by virtue of that, you know, their word is golden or what, you know, is holy. But on the other hand, so I went to a pretty, I wouldn't say it was the most conservative, nor was it the most liberal Catholic school. But, you know, starting first grade, I mean, we were taught both, you know, like the story of Genesis, but also, you know, also taught that that's not quite how it happened, that this is a story. And, you know, like things like evolution were always, of course.
Science had a place.
Oh, yeah. You know, and, you know, by second grade, I remember learning about gravity, and I think both religion and science class used gravity as an example of something you can't see, but it's still there. And so there was no conflict. In fact, of course, there was science.
Okay.
You know, and yeah.
Let's jump ahead. You were interested in pursuing medical school. How did that live in you? And did you feel that was connected to your religious background, or did you have it as separate from that?
I wouldn't say that that was particularly connected to it. I mean, I may see it now in retrospect as a bit more so, because I do feel that I am fortunate to have found a vocation that's very meaningful to me. But I wasn't thinking about it like that at the time.
And psychiatry?
And psychiatry was a great place for me because I had so many interests, you know, from science to religion and humanities and literature. So I think psychiatry and psychoanalysis is a great place for someone who's interested in sort of the wide spectrum of the human experience.
And you had been in analysis before you pursued analytic training, or the other way around?
Well, they started around the same time. I mean, I started analysis while I was a psychiatry resident.
Uh-huh. And was religion present in your analysis? That is, was your religious background or your analyst religious background something that was that you spent time with that took on layers of meaning that were new and surprising? Or was it just in the background, not so spoken of?
Well, I actually knew that my analyst was interested in religion. I had had a supervisor who also was interested in psychiatry and religion and psychoanalysis. And so my analyst was one of the people he mentioned to me as someone who might be a good analyst, you know, for me. So I would say during this time, I was very interested in religion. A big experience around that time, at the end of medical school, I did a rotation at the Zuni Indian Reservation. And there I was able to see some of their traditional religion being practiced, the dances that have this hypnotic quality, coordinated to the seasons of the year. And mm-hmm. at the same time, they had a Christian church, a Catholic church there, that the only like Christian symbol in it was the cross. And the, you know, where usually you'd find saints and so on, you had the cycle, is they had painted the cycle, the Zuni cycle of the year on the walls of the Catholic church. And people felt comfortable practicing both. They did not see any conflict about it. They looked at you like, of course, I go to the dance, you know, around the spring equinox or whatever. And yes, then I can come to church on Sunday and I do this. So that was really the another place where I saw this combination of the connection to nature, to the world, that there is something, that there is a spiritual experience within the communities, but they were also seeing something that, you know, Catholicism was bringing to them and not in contradiction. So I found this very interesting. This was at the end of medical school. It's also like that's in the desert. So the desert is conducive to spiritual experiences, interestingly. I had some of that too, because, you know, there's monks that live in the desert and so on. And I think it's not by chance, but just things like when you're in the sun, you feel so alive, and you might even feel like the sun, you could almost feel like a part of the universe. And then when you're in the shade, it feels so different. And this it very much, I think that was a time when something clicked about that there could be so many layers and the both and aspect of it. So this was also a time that I was writing, I had started exploring poetry, and I would say towards the end of high school and through this period of time, some of the poetry was exploring religion. Quite a bit of it was. And I did write some poems about the Zuni experience. And I brought some of that actually to my analysis. And I do remember at first my analyst maybe was a little hesitant about whether I was going to read a poem, but then there was some kind of click that I could almost hear, you know, like, oh, yes, it was of interest, and it allowed us to to discuss. I particularly remember reading the poem that I recently sent you about the christening, for example. Yes. Yeah. And that was a turning point.
Did you find that over the course of your analysis that your religious thinking, beliefs, affiliation, did it evolve over time, or did it sort of end up where it started?
I think it maybe matured some or got clearer. It was an opportunity to explore it. But if anything, I think it was more affirmational of it.
Okay.
I mean, it's not like it's in fact the opposite of like my residency classmates would tease me that if I was going to be in analysis, I would get cured of Catholicism. And that did not happen at all.
But you discovered it wasn't an illness, right?
Right.
You've mentioned the word spirituality a number of times. So for completeness, can you help us understand what you mean by that, in specific, how that lives for you in relation to your relationship to God?
Okay. Well, I'm going to quote Rumer Godden, who is a writer. There is an Indian belief that everyone is a house of four rooms, a physical, a mental, an emotional, and a spiritual room. Most of us tend to live in one room most of the time, but unless we go into every room every day, even if only to keep it aired, we are not complete. So, what's the spiritual room? For me, it does tend to be a connection to something greater than just me. It is a contemplative space. It is getting to the core of who I am, allowing for the best of me to come to the fore, to have space for grace or allow for grace.
Okay. And is that synonymous for you with God, or is that not an important question?
No, I think that the way I understand God or experience God, you know, in some ways there is a way I don't know if there is a God, but I do experience something greater than myself, and the concept that God is everywhere, the possibility for the sacred, we may just not always see it, can be present everywhere. So I don't particularly feel like it's highly connected, let's say, to the person of, let's say, Jesus, necessarily, although he is a, you know, was important, obviously, for Catholicism and some of the important ideas of Catholicism, that he assumed he was incarnate. So the physical becomes a part of the sacred also.
And that the combination of the human and the divine is what you feel is valuable about that.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we've spoken of prayer and your sense of how it gives you access to an interiority. Can you say something about that?
Well, in some ways, learning to pray is it's a skill. Or you learn how to pray. You might see your parents praying, your grandmother praying. You might learn certain prayers. But at some point you learn things like you can tell God anything. So it's a, there's some permission to explore, be open to what comes up. In some ways, it's a, learning a conversation with the other. There's certain kinds of things one might learn to put, you know, have in prayer, like gratitude, or there's the concept of listening to what God is saying to you. So all of that does help one to learn a certain kind of contemplation. There's things like, you know, we pray in Catholic school, we prayed before each class, let's say in high school. So it was something that was, that happened every day. So it's, it was a way, and actually sometimes we would use the typical prayers, but this was a place where people could talk about, you know, what intentions do we have? So, you know, the girls would say, my grandmother is sick. It might be to pray for our, you know, for us to do well on the test. It, like there was all kinds of things one can bring to it. And you actually learned about what's going on with other people at that time. So there's, you know, there's private prayer, there's group prayer.
Let me ask you a question. You're one of perhaps the few individuals who I can ask this to. You described prayer to God as being able to say anything to God. And that, of course, is something that one is invited to do with one's analyst. Mm-hmm. Say anything. How do those two freedoms and experiences compare to each other?
Well, in some ways, it might initially still feel safer with God because there's this whole idea that God knows everything anyways. But on the other hand, it does maybe prepare you for the idea that that is a possibility. So, in fact, we do try to create a space where a patient can say anything. Now, and you know, in Catholicism, there's also the experience of going to confession. And there's some debate about, well, why do you even need to say it to another person? You know, whatever sins you might have. But, you know, you could just deal with it directly with God. But I think that you could say that having another person, he, these days priests are still only male, but he can help. There, it is sort of hard, but it is also something that helps you by saying it out loud, helps you deal with whatever it is that's paining you.
Let me stay on this, if I may, just for a moment. It would mm-hmm. seem to me that the inhibitions that we all have to speak freely to our analyst is because we have imaginings about what it means to them, what the consequences will be, built on our childhood presumptions. And also built upon the, you talk about the physicality of Jesus being an important component, the physicality and the immediacy, the presence of the analyst. It would seem to me, adds a richness to the dangers of that signal inhibition that need to be worked through. Whereas to God, it seems that a lot of that is bypassed because those, the physical immediacy, the common humanity, the sexuality of the analytic moment is, I can't say what it is, but it seems like it's something else. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, but there still is the self-censoring in prayer that would occur.
Really? Okay. So. You mentioned something of great interest to me. You, A, introduced me to the what a narthex is, N-A-R-T-H-E-X. And I'm going to ask you to share with our listeners what a narthex is and how you find that relevant to your clinical encounter.
Okay, so this was part of our discussions of what impact, I'd say intrapsychically, religion has. And we can even talk about the architecture that we experience. So the narthex is something that I became particularly aware of when my husband and I took a trip to Burgundy, France, and there are a lot of Romanesque cathedrals there. And so Romanesques are pre-Gothic, and they tend to have thick walls and maybe lots of spaces. But before you even go into the church, there's the narthex, or the waiting room,
yeah.
Which is like the waiting room. And there was one cathedral we went into. There was so much to experience just in the narthex that it was an experience in itself. And we almost like forgot that, oh, yeah, then there's the rest of the cathedral to see. But I know that patients, so I pretty consciously, when setting up my office, did want to set up a contemplative space. Now, all of us are going to have a waiting room usually also, but it becomes clear that there's something that there are things that are happening in the waiting room, in the narthex. And recently a patient said, you know, like when I was a little bit late, he said, that's okay. I just had a little bit more time in the narthex. I mean, he and I specifically used that terminology, or sometimes he's not quite ready for me to, you know, come out and end the narthex part of what he's doing. So those structures, even if I may not accept all of Catholicism, but this experience, let's say, of churches, you know, so there's the Romanesque churches, which have these very, really are very conducive to shutting out, you know, distractions from the rest of the world, and, you know, have thick walls and basically spaces for contemplation are part of my experience. You know, Gothic cathedrals, which have beautiful stained glass and let in, you know, diffractions from the sun, the dancing of colors, as well as the going up to, you know, kind of into a transcendent space, is also part of my experience. Mm-hmm. And it's actually structured. There are things like, there's a similarity to me, like every analytic session has certain things that are the same, but also every time, every single analytic session is going to be different. Just like every mass has the same structure, but absolutely there will never ever be two masses that are the same. They will always be new. So, and even if, for example, I am in this sabbatical phase, that doesn't mean that these structures are not there with me. I think that they are. Actually, I thought I might read a quote from Seamus Heaney, who's an Irish, very well-known Irish poet. Mm-hmm. It is said, you know, he talked about losing his religion, but here's something he wrote in memory of Czeslaw Milos. He says, another poet, by the way, "Like everybody else, I bowed my head during the consecration of the bread and wine, lifted my eyes to the raised host and raised chalice, believed, whatever it means, that a change occurred. I went to the altar rails and received the mystery on my tongue, returned to my place, shut my eyes fast, made an act of thanksgiving, opened my eyes and felt time starting up again. There was never a scene when I had it out with myself or with another. The loss occurred off stage, and yet I cannot disavow words like Thanksgiving or host or communion bread. They have an undying tremor and draw, like well water far down.
Certainly an example of interiority that we were speaking of before. Mm-hmm. Ginta, I want to make sure we have time to take up the issue of abortion. It is something that you have published on in the past and have thoughts about.
You know, even before, there was something that we talked about that I think I would just like to... So in terms of describing what happens in the office, I mean, I think that things like having experiences or of transcendence, experiencing, you know, I am humbled by what people bring to tell me. I take what I'm doing in the office very seriously, because it's really like sacred work in terms of people being able to, you know, to work, love, and play. I mean, that is for them to find their real callings, you could say, you know, rather than the false selves that they, you know, may experience. Yeah, it's a similar call for finding one's true self, and that is, you know, really important work.
I think that's clearly, it comes across from you, the commonality between the presence of religion in your life and the presence of your work in your life, and that it's a sense of the sacred. And thank you for sharing that. I think many of us know that in our own idioms, but don't often say it as clearly as you just did, so thank you. In your paper, which is entitled A Review of the Psychoanalytic Literature on Abortion, you actually come up with a quote from Freud on the subject of abortion. Now, I have never seen a quote from Freud before, and I want to thank you for finding that. The quote is, and it's from his 1920 paper, The Psychogenesis of a Case of Homosexuality in a Woman, and he writes, quote, "One is also amazed at the unexpected results that may follow on artificial abortion, the killing of an unborn child, which had been decided upon without remorse and without hesitation," close quote. Now, it needs to be said that I don't know the original German, and I don't know how accurate the translation is to the killing of an unborn child. That's obviously an important statement. It's a politically loaded statement. If someone listening can inform us about what the original German said, I and I think many would feel grateful. But that's Freud's statement on it. Your statement on it in the first paragraph of this paper is, I'll read just a bit. Quote, "The phenomenon of abortion, whether it takes place in conjunction with analysis or otherwise, is an enactment particularly suited for the examination of human choice and action at the interface of fantasy and external reality. It has multiple implications for technique, as well as our understanding of human development and such core human dilemmas as destructiveness versus creativity." You want to share with us your experiences and feelings about the subject?
So this paper came to be around the time, and a couple other presentations I did came about because I was pregnant several times working as a therapist and analyst. I have two children, and so two pregnancies, and also I had one miscarriage before that. So pregnancy was in the room for really, you know, several mm-hmm. years during my work with patients. And it coincided with a time when several patients brought either pregnancy or abortion to the fore. one of my first analytic cases, the sort of central theme was that the, you know, basically the worst thing she's ever done is have an abortion, and really conceptualized her life around that sin, which she would, you know, she used that word.
And you use air quotes when you said sin, is that right?
Yeah, well, I mean, my understanding of sin is not being in a good place around something.
Okay.
Okay, so it's not, I think it would be seen that way. She was not in a good place around us.
Okay.
Sure. I mean, I also had a situation. I worked at Chestnut Lodge, and this was very disturbing, but at some point became clear that one of my patients became pregnant as a result of competing with me to get pregnant before I did, you know, and then she had an abortion. And you can imagine that that's a complicated situation. But it, the pregnancy and abortion came up a lot during this period of time, whether it was because I was pregnant or these patients arrived on my doorstep, so to say. So, and probably, I think, so partly this was just due to the what I was dealing with clinically, but I think that Catholicism, you know, in Catholic schools and Catholicism in general did explore abortion. So I was aware of that. And there is this idea of the consistent ethic of life that is present in Catholicism. So that alerted me that this is an important topic. It's something in that area is discussed a lot, but I would say it's not really discussed much within the psychiatric or psychoanalytic literature.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the thing about, so in a presentation, I did discuss these clinical cases some more. It's often, I guess, seen as the issue of choice, for example. I would say that except in cases of rape and incest, there is, prior to the decision about whether to have a child or not, there is a decision that someone makes whether to have intercourse or not and what to do about it, whether one has uses birth control and so on. So when one thinks about making choices, there's a, even, I think we neglect that there was, most of the time, there's already a choice that happens prior to the choice, you know, to whether one is going to have an abortion or not. So, and I think a lot of times there's an unawareness for probably defensive reasons or neurotic reason, you know, that someone gets her, can get into that situation where then they are faced with mm-hmm. the question of whether or not to have an abortion.
You've mentioned in your article that in your review, which is a bit dated but still covers a fair amount of territory, that there's no mention of countertransference in the consideration.
Yeah, I mean, to what extent, you know, like, let's say with the situation where somebody got pregnant in competition with me to get pregnant before
mm-hmm.
I did. Oh my gosh, I felt terrible about that.
You felt terrible because, are you saying that had you been more aware of it or brought it to her attention, she might not have acted it out?
Yeah, I did not become aware of it. No, not the, she made the decision to have the abortion without talking to me very much about it.
Oh, I meant to getting pregnant. I thought I didn't know.
Oh, yeah, she did not know. I mean, but this was, there were many kinds of ways that she sabotaged, you know, like there's also suicidal gestures so on that were happening. So that's, you know, an impulsive move maybe. I guess even just that the idea that someone, it did not even possibly cross my mind that someone could get pregnant, would do this just in competition.
I understand.
For example.
And you felt badly about it because?
Was there something about the therapeutic situation that evoked it?
That you were responsible for and didn't otherwise arise organically from her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, no, I think it did. I wouldn't go to that extent, but maybe. And I'm not even feeling like somebody more experienced or something would have, you know, handled it differently.
Let me ask you a question before we have to go. What's it like to be someone who holds these beliefs, whether on or off sabbatical, who holds them close to you, close to your heart, close to your mind, and be an analyst? I mean, I think it's fair to say that our field is not terribly welcoming to those who identify as religious. I think people might agree that our work is sacred, but they more likely will mean that in the most secular ways. And I think you mean it other than that. I think you mean it in part a religious sense. What's that like? What's been your journey like in our field? And what is it like for you to live in our field in a bit of an outlier status?
You know, in some ways, I don't feel that my exploring religion or having that in my life in various ways has been particularly difficult in the setting that I'm in. I mean, like I said, I know that my analyst was interested in the subject. When we were advanced candidates, we had a class on psychoanalysis and religion. I proposed and organized a weekend for the New Directions writing program on taking a look at psychoanalysis and religion. And so within that context, I don't feel that much of an outsider. Now, there are ways I am something of an outsider, or even let's say by describing myself as a Lithuanian Catholic, I'm putting myself a bit on the outside of Catholicism in general. Mm-hmm. That it's a specific version of Catholicism. Mm-hmm. So, and there are ways that probably in truth, I think there is a way that an outsider perspective is something that is part of who I am also. So, I think I've kind of come to accept that may be even something that I gravitate to. I think it is a little bit similar to what my father did in how he thought about things. But so, you know, I think there might be other you know, maybe in other places it would have been more of an issue. I really don't think that's been that big of an issue. Now, sometimes you have a situation where someone refers someone to, or somebody wants a Catholic or a Christian psychiatrist.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, that I think is really pretty defensive in terms of wanting to, you know, take certain things for granted and that they would not be examined, really.
Yeah, that happens more and more these days.
Yeah.
And perhaps your outsider status, to call it that, is sort of a necessary part of the job description for analysts, because we're always in the experience and outside the experience at the same time.
Right. And analysts are a little bit outsiders all along.
For sure. Yeah, for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
So So I'm an insider if I'm an outsider.
There you go. Ginta, I want to thank you for being a part of this conversation. I learned a great deal from both reading your work and also speaking with you. And I think the more we can speak more freely, whether it be to God or whether it be to our analyst or whether it be to our colleagues, that we can speak freely about these matters that have otherwise been, again, as I say, some space between private and secret. I think there may not be so much danger in owning our religious attachments and affiliations. And perhaps in some ways, like you've spoken about the interiority of prayer and the layering of meanings, it can even be part of deepening our work. So I want to thank you for sharing it both with me and our listeners. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. We can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.